Major Allen, are you one? You were telling me earlier that you landed at Normandy on D plus one.
Yes.
Can you tell me which unit you were with and in what capacity you were serving?
Well, I was with the 113 Light Attack Regiment, and I was in the recce party of the regiment, which was composed of three batteries, and I was in 368 battery. And we landed at Sword Beach, I remember, and it was heavily pillboxed, and we got into a house and took that as a headquarters. It's a picture, that picture over there. And we dug various holes in the courtyard and lined them with wardrobes. And we stayed there for quite a considerable time. Other batteries covered Pegasus Bridge and various features, the locks at the mouth of the River Orne. And while we were there, we watched the tremendous raid at Caen. You know, the huge bomber raid, and they came over endlessly. I remember about four or five one night, and dropped so much stuff that it stopped any any advance that we made at all. I think it was the 51st. I think the Highland Division was there. And
so it was hampered the advance?
It hampered the advance in the end. It was really too much, I think. It clogged all the communications. But it was quite a long time, really, we were penned into the beachhead. Seemed that we would never believe the dream that Montgomery unfolded in his O group, that we would break out eventually. But, of course, when we did, we did. And I remember going through Falaise and seeing the destruction to the, I don't know, it was the 14th Army, I think, but it was a whole army was left, very reminiscent of the scenes that we've just seen in the Gulf, you know, fleeing stuff that had been hemmed into the Falaise Gap and trapped, and it was just shot to pieces.
Did your unit take part in the bombardment of the Germans in the Falaise Gap?
No, not at all. No, we were ACAC, and our primary task was, you know, anti-aircraft work, really. So we did very seldom really were involved in groundwork like anti-tank. We did fire tracer paths sometimes, but no actual... Sometimes we used an anti-tank role, but not often.
Were there many German planes in Normandy to shoot at?
Well, surprisingly enough, we weren't harassed, really, but our planes, although they had air superiority, did meet German opposition in the air, there's no doubt. But the German planes did not, as a rule, attack ground forces. They weren't confident enough to do that, I don't think. But they did fight our planes and bring our planes down.
Did your unit have to fire at any German planes?
Quite a lot. We had quite a heavy engagement when we were at Wistrom, because I don't know why, but it was right on the extreme edge of the Allied flank, and so we did get quite a lot of work to do there.
You said that you landed on D plus one,
yeah,
on Sword Beach. Was
yeah.
it a peaceful or an opposed landing as far as you were concerned?
Well, remarkably quiet, very, very peculiar, feeling. There had been obviously very heavy fighting, but the fighting on the actual pillbox front and so on had been more or less the commandos had done a tremendous job, and there was very little opposition there.
What did the beaches look like when you landed?
Well, they're full of still full of tank obstacles in parts, but of course the places where we landed were free, and we had no trouble at all.
Had the dead bodies been removed?
No, they're still there. Still there.
D Did you see anything of the commandos or the airborne at Pegasus Bridge?
Oh, yes, they were there. But, of course, they'd gone further to the other side. They've got a bulge out from the bridge and established a bridgehead on the what I would call the enemy side of the river. But it was a very, very small bridge, of course, and the little canal and the lock beside it and the famous cafe, which I believe has been sold recently, I think. I read in the paper.
When you landed in Normandy, did you feel confident that the Allied forces would be able to break out of the beachhead?
Well, it's a hard question really to answer. I think we all had a certain amount of trepidation and wondering, in spite of what we'd been told and so on, that it would work, that it would really be effective. We didn't know, but of course as time went on we became more confident, really. Especially when we got news about the American landings and so on further along the beach, and the opening of the, I've forgotten the name of the harbour now, the Mulberry, but I forget what port it was at, but of course that came, and supplies and reinforcements came rolling in.
What do you remember about the pursuit of the Germans from Norway up into the Low Countries, as far as you personally took part in it?
Well, as I've said, we broke out, or really we didn't break out, the armoured people broke out, obviously. But it was just like a car ride, really. It was absolutely absurd. The speed of the advance was incredible, because we started off from I've forgotten the name of the place now. I've got no map with me here. But we crossed the Seine at Les Andelys, and we started moving from then at tremendous speed. We went through the Somme and saw the Menin Gate and all the rest of it without any opposition at all, and we went breezing along until we found ourselves in Brussels.
What kind of reception did you get from French civilians?
Oh, incredible. Incredible. I mean, they got in the way, throwing everything in the air, and flowers, and great reception, really.
Had that been the case also in Normandy?
Yes, I think so. I remember in Normandy, we were at a place called Thierry Harcourt, and we got into a farm which had been used by Jerry, and we'd settled down more or less there in the barns and outbuildings and so on, and the chappie came along, Monsieur Laurent, and he was the man who owned the farm building, and he was in a terrible state. He'd lost his wife, and she'd gone to another village down the road. And so anyway, I got my jeep and shoved him in the jeep, and we went off down, and we recovered her, and oh, he was tremendous. He went to the garden and dug up his champagne reserve. And it was wonderful hospitality.
How old was he?
Oh, he was about 55. But he wrote to me a long, long time after the war, and he said various books and presents to my children and so on. And he and his wife are now dead.
What do you remember of the entry into Brussels?
Well, as I've said, I mean, it was very difficult to proceed along the road because of the crowds of people who were, you know, lining the road. We were fortunate. We had a Belgian liaison officer with us, Captain, Not sure. Captain Levy, and he lived in Brussels actually, and he was most useful as a liaison officer. And as I say, we got to Brussels and we pushed on towards Antwerp, and we came back. We retreated, as it were, back, and based ourselves in Brussels for a time. And
you were telling me earlier that you accompanied the Irish Guards
who thrust
towards Arnhem to try to relieve the troops.
Yes. Well, I always remember at Zonne Bridge there was Colonel Vandeleur and the Irish Guards, and he forced his way across an extremely difficult crossing of a river. I forget what it was, the river, the Zonne Bridge, but the Zonne Bridge itself had been destroyed. And he, with his, you know, leadership and so on, just made his men just run after him. They got right across. And it was there, as I said, that we had contact with the 82nd Airborne. I remember I got a job of trying to liaise with the airborne lot, and as a result of that I got the Bronze Cross, United States Bronze Cross, and a mention in dispatches. But they were a funny lot, because I remember spending a very uncomfortable night one night in a kind of a cellar, and they were very itchy triggered paratroopers who... I don't know what they did to the Germans, but they put the wind at me.
What kind of a man was Vandeleur, from what you could see of him?
Oh, incredible. Just an incredible man, total disregard of his own safety, and great powers of leadership, obviously. But really, you know, if you called him a mad major about it, I should think.
What did he carry with him?
A swagger stick. That was all. Well, he had his revolver, obviously, but that was it. His swagger stick was a thing. He used that at every occasion, just to whack his leg with it and throw it forward. Wherever he was, like Richard, you know, throwing the heart forward, he threw his stick forward and followed it.
What do you think his men thought of him?
The world. The world. Yes.
What did you do with your unit in the Netherlands?
Well, as I say, after, you know, Brussels and crossing the Somme and so on, we went to the bridges over the Esco and the Albert canals, and went through on the way to relieve or give air protection at Arnhem. We crossed the Rhine at Nijmegen and liaised with a Polish airdrop, which was there to support the Arnhem people. But of course, as you know, we Arnhem, they came out of Arnhem, they crossed the river at night, and they were in a terrible state when they came over. And we were stationed for a time at Nijmegen, near the Great Bridge. It was always a horrible affair crossing the bridge, because Jerry had 88 trained on it, and you had to, you know, wait for one to, or a salvo to go, and then just scoot across the bridge as fast as one could. And our headquarters was on the other side of the Rhine, and we were there for some time. But we were there, I think, I forget the name of the place which is north of Nijmegen, where the Polish people were.
Oosterbeek?
No, not as far as Oosterbeek. Oosterbeek was on the No, I haven't got a map, unfortunately. But that was a bit of a... Well, it was all right, I suppose, but I think the poles got dropped in the wrong place myself, because they were dropped really halfway between Nijmegen and the Lower Rhine and the Upper Rhine, and they should have been dropped higher up, I think.
How did you spend that winter? In great discomfort?
Not really. We were... Don't laugh. We were in a piano factory. It was fairly comfortable.
Where was that?
At Nijmegen, on the North Bank. And I think we were there, actually, when we were kind of getting ready for a Christmas dinner, you know, all the officers were getting the dinner ready for blokes and so on. And we got an order to get up and pack, you know, straight away, which we did, and we found ourselves on the way to the Ardennes, Givet and so on, all that, in the bitter cold weather. And of course we saw plenty of Jerry aeroplane there. I mean, sometimes the regiments on the move are firing the guns off their wheels, you know, going along.
Were you very effective against the German Air Force in the Ardennes offensive, do you think?
Well, we certainly kept them away, kept them off the road. I mean, a Bofors is not a terribly, you know, effective weapon except against low-flying aircraft. But we gave as good as we got, I think, really. And then in the Ardennes, we went through Dinant and then on to Givet. And we came into no contact at all with Germans in the Ardennes whatsoever. But I think that the Second Army had been moved, or units by Monty, to back up the Americans, really. But I think the Americans... After there was a period of very bad flying weather in which the Germans, you know, really got into the air. But after that, they died down and we saw very, very little of them.
Did you actually hit German planes with your AA guns?
Oh, I should think so, yes. Various guns had, you know, planes marked on, stenciled on, whether optimistically or not, I wouldn't swear, but they did claim, they did have certain claims, yes.
And what do you remember about going into Germany? Was it in February?
Well, let me see, it must have been. Because we went to the Maas, the crossings of the Maas, and then the Rhine crossings at Xanten and Reese. You know, pontoon bridges were flung across, and we crossed the Rhine there. And, of course, we saw airborne troops used there with great effect in the Rhine crossing. And there was very little opposition, especially not in the air, because it just wasn't there. Then, of course, we went along. We were still, I forget, well, we were in 12th Corps then, I think, but we went into 8th Corps area, and we suddenly, you know, got an order to move. Well, it was a peculiar kind of order, because we were told we're not told, really, the destination, or what the destination was, but we were going under a flag of truce, which was a most peculiar feeling. And it was quite a long journey. We took the whole regiment, about 220 miles, I think it was, in 24 hours, which wasn't bad going, really. And then we arrived at Belsen. And... we weren't the first unit in, of course, at all, because a troop of the 53rd, was it? No, I'm sorry. The 63rd Anti-Tank Regiment had been there before, about a week before, and our recce group arrived. The Germans applied for a truce. They were frightened of Belsen, of the state it was in, the disease, and they were frightened that if, you know, the camp inmates got out, the typhus and so on, infection, disease would spread. And they applied for to 8th Corps for a truce. And on that was on the 13th of April. On the 15th, the 63rd Anti-Tank Regiment went in, and also our recce group. And then the main body of the regiment moved under a flag of truce on the 19th of April, and the 63rd Anti-Tank Regiment was relieved.
So you went in on the 19th, personally?
Yes, the 19th.
Had you been warned about what to expect?
Not really. We were told it was, you know, a difficult situation, but the extent of the problem and so on had not really been fully, well, it probably hadn't been fully known, but we certainly weren't told. It was a quite unexpected sight, the sight that we met. We came in and it was dark, and we came in and kind of settled down for the night, more or less, and then the extent of the what was before us came to light in the morning, and of course it was the most horrific sight.
Can you describe in detail what you saw?
Well, the only way really to describe it is the fact that there just was a carpet of human bodies, mostly very emaciated, many of them unclothed, jumbled together. People had just died where they stood, and they were outside and inside, of course, the various huts, but they were outside, you know, lying where there were trees or any open ground. Just went on. It was incredible, the mass of the bodies didn't putrefy because they were so skeletal. There was so little flesh on them. Their arms and their legs were just like matchsticks, really. But it was a gruesome, horrible sight. I'll never forget. Never.
And the smell?
Straight. Well, as I say, I don't know whether it was the fact that they were so spare and lean. It was a very unpleasant smell. It was incredible, but not so much as one would expect. I mean, I'd smelt worse, you know, in Normandy through, you know, killed cows and so on, lying in fields, getting putrescent and so on, but that wasn't so bad. Inside the huts, of course, it was appalling, because not only were the living, who could hardly do anything, could hardly move or do anything for themselves, but, of course, there were bodies inside as well. So the big thing was, of course, that we had to do something about the bodies and remove them and give them some burial. It was impossible to do anything except bury in mass pits, and of course the ground was rather sandy there. Bulldozers were very little use because the soil, as I say, was so sandy. Even when it was wet it down to try and get bulldozers, so shoveling had to be done. That wasn't done, it was done by the Hungarians, with a large Hungarian force of troops left there. There had been prison guards, and they were given shovels and they had to dig pits. And into these pits the bodies were gradually put. There were, I should imagine, I think a pretty good estimate that there were about over 10,000 corpses to bury. And there were five great pits buried. And to carry the poor emaciated remains in, they had to be... It was a great difficulty, really, you know, with lorries. We had to construct ramps and so on to let people carry the bodies up. And German troops were used, and the SS troops were used sometimes for this, and the British soldiers were, you know, supervisory capacity all the time, watching the pits being gradually filled up. And when they were filled up, just earth was spread over the top and put down about 2 foot high, and a notice was put up, the date, number of bodies, approximate number of bodies. Eventually, after the big burial got reduced, we were able to have individual burials. And over all the burials, I know the our padre, Reverend Ross, he was a marvellous man.
Were you scared of getting any disease yourself?
Oh, yes, we were frightened. Well, I was frightened to death. I think we all were frightened because, I mean, typhus was rampant and so on. And we thought that, you know, we might get, you know, just disease transmitted and an outbreak amongst the troops. But it never happened. I mean, people got ill through, I think, psychological reasons and so on, really. But as far as I know, in 113 Nitakak Regiment, there were no cases of typhus.
Were you spread?
Yes. Oh, powdered. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, and when you went into an area, you were powdered, and when you came out, you were powdered, dusted down.
Did you detect any vermin or fleas on your body?
No, no. I mean, the inmates obviously were, you know, infested, but... We didn't really. I think the precautions that were taken were pretty effective. I mean, we had this, presumably, I don't know the chemical name for it, powder, but anyway, it was, you know, syringe, and we had a good supply of those things. And everybody, you know, followed the instructions.
So your unit had been drafted into Belsen with a specific purpose of helping clear up?
Well, there were various jobs. Obviously, there was the burial, which I've mentioned before, but there was also the job, of course, of feeding and cleansing the people who were inside. And to cleanse them, we had to operate a kind of a human laundry in which people had to be washed and scrubbed and so on, but ever so gently, because, of course, their skin was like paper over, just stretched over bone. And to get help for that, we got German nurses in from Celle, and they helped in the laundry. And so, a lot of them contracted typhus. There were about 50, I think, of those nurses, and I think about 30 of them died.